from HanselMinutes.com. It's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 180, recorded live Thursday, September 17th, 2009. Support for Hansel Minutes is provided by Telerik RAD Controls, the most comprehensive suite of components for Windows Forms and ASP.NET web applications. Online at www.telerik.com. In this episode, Scott talks about rich internet application services with Brad Abrams.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman, and this is another episode of Hansel Minutes, and I'm sitting down today with Brad Abrams. Brad runs a team in the .NET framework for Microsoft, and you may have heard his name over the years in reference to the base class libraries. What are you working on now, Brad?
Hey, Scott. So I'm working on two very fun projects. I love working on V1 projects. So one is the managed extensibility framework, and the other is .NET RIA services.
.NET RIA services. So RIA is Rich Internet Application?
That's right. You're going to love these names. We have these extensive marketing guys at Microsoft who come up with these beautiful names.
Yeah, that is not a good name.
So really what we're trying to do with RIA services is make it way easier to build N-tier applications.
N-tier.
N-tier. So if you look at the vast majority of developers on the .NET platform today, and maybe this is true outside the .NET platform too, they're mostly building two-tier apps. They have a database somewhere, and they have some UI. Maybe the UI is in PHP or ASP.NET, and maybe it's not the best practice in the world, but a lot of the times the UI connects directly to that database, pulls data out, and displays it. We often see that's true in client apps and WinForms apps and WPF apps. A lot of those DB6 apps have line of sight directly to the database. And as we move, does that resonate with you? Do you think that's
Yeah,
true?
It does. Now, I've always made a big differentiation in my mind between tiers and layers. Is that an agreed upon taxonomy, or is that just me?
You know, that's a great question. So we argue about that a lot internally. No, I don't think there's any great standard on that. So what do you mean by layers?
So for me, I've always said in architecture, probably over the last, I don't know, 5 or 6 years, that a layer is a logical thing and a tier is a physical thing. So you might have a multi-layered thing. It may be three layers, but it's really only two tiers, tiers being physical.
Yeah, I agree. So I guess we're talking about layers here. And I would venture to say most developers, the distinction would be lost on them, and they're not putting layers in their products either.
Okay.
To some extent, you know, Microsoft's to blame for some of that. I mean, if you take a look at a lot of the demos and examples that we've done for WinForms and for ASP.NET, you know, a lot of them do show ASP.NET app connecting directly to a database.
So this is a website talking directly to SQL Server using, you know, the SQL Server protocol.
Yeah. So we have back in the day, we introduced data sources, and we have ADO.NET data source and all of that jazz. And now we have a link to SQL and Entity Framework. But still, that's effectively still going directly against the database.
And this is bad. Why?
Why is that bad?
Well, I know, but I have to play the interviewer.
Well, I think a lot of architects could complain about that. But to be honest with you, because of things like scale and flexibility and maintenance of the code. But I think it really becomes a problem when you start moving into these what I would call RIA application patterns with AJAX and with Silverlight. It's not really possible to do that direct line of sight to the database anymore. Right, you have to go through a web tier. And all of a sudden, we've taken this huge mass of developers that know how to do these two-tier apps, and you've moved them into a fundamentally three-tier world where now there's the database, there's a middle tier, and there's where the client's running, either in AJAX or Silverlight or Flash for that.
Okay. Is it primarily a RIA, a rich internet application problem? Or is it a problem of scale? Because we always used to think when we were building large systems that the issue was going to be that we'd need some intermediate machine. We'd have a web server that would talk to a business layer server that would talk to a database, and that would provide us more scale because we could say well, I need more web servers, they're working hard, or I could say I need more business servers, they're working hard. Is this an issue of protocol in that I don't want my browser talking directly to my database, or is this an issue of scale, or is it both?
In some ways, I think it's both. I think it's, first, mm-hmm. there's kind of a security issue with exposing the database kind of on a web tier that has some people. It's more obvious that you're doing that, and so it makes people nervous to go do that. We don't see a lot of Ajax apps talking TDS, for example. That's the protocol that SQL Server talks directly. And then I think it is also a scale issue. One of the ways I think about it, and this may sound a little bit pejorative, a little bit kind of fatherly, but I think whenever there's an inflection point in the industry, it's Microsoft's responsibility to move customers through that inflection point in a way that leads to a better architecture in the end. So, for example, I do think we're in a big inflection point now where we're moving into a more of a RHEA application pattern. And to help developers move there better, we're going to make building the kind of correct architecture with an N-tier pattern a lot easier for them to go do.
Now, when you say that we're moving into more of a RHEA pattern, does that mean Flash and Silverlight, or does that mean that we have a lot more capabilities on the client, and that does that include JavaScript itself?
Yeah, I think, you know, I don't know if I'm the official Microsoft spokesman on what RHEA is, but certainly as I look at the industry, I think RHEA includes things like Ajax, Silverlight, Flash. And essentially, I think the key element of Ajax, mm-hmm. you know, in the past, of RHEA, is in the past we have done a lot of arguing about, you know, should our client apps better or our web apps better? And client apps have a lot of benefit. They can take advantage of the hardware. They can have a rich user experience. And web apps are better because they're easier to deploy. And fundamentally, these questions, you know, because there's no great answer to that. So what I think the RHEA pattern is doing, is we're approaching it from both sides, saying, how does the web get richer, and you're seeing that with Ajax today. There's some very rich Ajax applications that, you know, are every bit as rich as many desktop apps. And then you're seeing on the desktop side, us making the deployment significantly easier. And now with Silverlight, we're getting there with the ubiquity thing. We're very close to the same ease of deployment as you see with standard web apps. But you have significantly more richness.
Okay, so let's take it down to a more of a wire protocol minute for a minute here. So when I've done, and again, this was, you know, a couple of years ago in banking, we had messaging over the wire, which was, you know, we used to call it ASMX, right? Web services, and then it became WS Star, you know, the web services interoperability stack. So whether it be ASMX or WCF, kind of classic. Indigo was the code name at the time. We were talking about passing angle brackets around via HTTP that described messages. We had a post office kind of a metaphor. We had envelopes and we had addressing and we had message bodies. And that is good. And then that works fine when you are sending messages. And then there was REST, the representational state transfer, and REST was an acceptance that HTTP has enough verbs that one could do CRUD, create, read, update, delete, over HTTP in a fairly robust way. And then there was JSON, which was basically like XML, except instead of angle brackets, you got curly braces, and it was a lot smaller, and JavaScript gobbled it up nicely. That's a lot of different choices for someone to make as far as things I can talk over port 80 and HTTP to my back end. What is RHEA's services as it relates to those existing protocols?
So the way you should think about RHEA services is it supports all of that. It's just a higher level programming model for building a WCF service. We've done a lot of work with WCF to support the angle brackets. That's its historical root. And we've also done work recently to support REST. Mm-hmm. More of a REST style of programming interface, as well as JSON directly from within WCF. So what we think is, actually the analogy I want to make is my first programming assignment ever, I actually got paid to write code. I was dealing with long and far, kind of far and short pointers. Right? Do you remember long pointers in the Win32F days? And
yeah, and thunking
was a big
is
deal
hard.
To have to go think about that, and it made kind of a lot. It stuck up a lot of life, right? And I think this question of do I do REST or do JSON? It's the same thing. Just 5 years from now, I hope we won't be having to spend a bunch of time talking about that. And the conversation will be moving up to the stack. Like, it'll just be a given that if you're writing a modern RIA service, that it supports all of it. Yes, fine. It turns out they're each good for one scenario. So, for example, JSON is by far the best thing to do if you have an AJAX client. If you have an AJAX client, you don't want to be parsing those SOAP envelopes. Like, that makes no sense whatsoever. But if you're talking .NET to .NET, which is in the case in many Silverlight apps, I'm running Windows Server and Windows .NET framework on the server, and on the client I'm running in Silverlight, hey man, that's .NET. Is there something we can do to have a super efficient protocol for that binary, blah, blah, blah? You see what I'm saying?
Okay, like remoting.
Yeah, so remoting back in the day did a very nice kind of efficient model. But the way we think about it today is actually in Silverlight 3, WCF introduced essentially binary SOAP. So it's still SOAP, but it's binary.
So it's the this is the binary XML. It's the SOAP object model squished and made efficient.
Yeah. But then I think what we need to think about as developers, as software engineers, is what is the programming surface that we're writing against? What's it look like to write this? And is the way I structure my server client logic different because I have a JSON head on this thing, or I have a REST head, or I have this binary head Silverlight? And our assertion is it's not that different.
Okay. So I want to just make clear for listeners, because I want to understand from the top down and from the bottom up, is there a change to the protocols that I know how to use? Does the wire format look different when I'm using RIA services?
No, the wire format is exactly WCF, what WCF offers. Today.
Okay.
So literally, when you build a RIA service, it is a WCF service.
So there's not something funny or fancy going on. Is there any kind of Microsoft specific namespace type stuff happening? Like, what if I wanted to call this with something else?
Yeah. Okay. So that's a great question. If you wanted to call, so our bread and butter scenario, so you got to start with a V1. So our V1 bread and butter scenario is definitely Silverlight client. So it's .NET on server, Silverlight. And there, we have a really great, kind of have a very high fidelity story going on. And then in fact, we do things like shared code. So you can write code on the server that executes on the client as well. We send a lot of really rich metadata to do things like validation. We send original values so that we can do change tracking and things like that. And then you're in V1, the question is, what does it look like to non-Silverlight clients? Well, what you will see, you will be able to walk up to a domain service that's our kind of base class for WCF, and ask it for its WSDL, and it'll give you the WSDL for all the operations that are on there. Mm-hmm. And you'll get what I would consider sort of base-level access to. We're working with the various parties to go figure out how to get things like shared code, the metadata enhancements we need into the WSDL. I don't know yet if that's going to make it into V1 or not. So what you'll see is a good amount of stuff, kind of the base level stuff in WSDL, and then over time, as we can evolve what's in WSDL, you'll see more and more there.
Okay, cool. So then talk about this programming model.
Yeah. So what I was going to say on the programming model, I think that is really the interesting part of the thing. And I think we can break it down into two parts, on the client and the server. So on the server, if you think about a lot of the services people right, they're essentially kind of CRUD-based service, create, update, delete, read records. And so we kind of noodled around that pattern a good bit. And on the read side, one of the big things that we've done is we've made it so you can write a service that returns an iQueryable. So, and you can implement the iQueryable however you want, maybe calling Link to SQL or any framework or in Hibernate's new Link support to create an iQueryable. And the advantage of the iQueryable is then from the client, you're able to do things like skip and take for paging or do filtering. And with some natural Link syntax on the client, we serialize that Link query up to the server and then run it against the iQueryable that you return from your method. So that means you can write kind of very familiar Link sort of code on the server and have that be highly efficient in terms of how it's accessed on the client. Does that make sense?
Okay. So does that mean that I am unaware? I was going to say ignorant, but am I unaware of what's happening on the wire? Is this a matter of you promise to return well-behaved iQueryable things and we'll handle the rest? Because no pun intended. Because there was a sense, remoting and before it decom was the beginning of moving object orientation to the web. And the mistake that object orientation when moved into a distributed system made was the lack of recognition of cost of moving across object boundaries. And the idea that, oh yeah, you just do this and look, you can call your object from New Zealand. Look at that. Your object doesn't even know that it's remoted. And the lack of recognition of that cost was a problem. And then service orientation was more of an acknowledgement that there is a service boundary. How much is this hiding from me, the fact that I'm going across a boundary?
So I think you'll see as I talk more about it, there is still an explicit boundary because as you say, I don't think it makes sense to completely hide the boundary from the user. But what I think we can do is make it easier to think about what is the plumbing stuff I have to do because of that boundary. And if there's plumbing stuff in there that doesn't help me understand the boundary, it's just kind of goo that I have to write, let's get rid of that. So, for example, I don't know how many times, I don't know, Scott, if you or your listeners have written a web service that supports paging, that takes a page count and a current page, come number of items in the pages, parameters, and applies the paging logic and returns the data that way. I certainly have seen a lot of customers go and do that. So why do we have to have everybody go do that? Can we just model the thing as an iQueryable and then support paging, sorting, filtering via the normal iQueryable mechanism for that?
Okay. And would I want to use that layer from anything else? Or is this one of these things where I have to derive from a certain object and then I can only use it for this purpose?
Well, I do think that that's a general, if you think about it long term, there's nothing specific about Silverlight in needing that scenario. So I do suspect that we're working super closely with the WCF guys. I do suspect that over time, they have a lot of the concepts that we're talking about with RIA services today just baked into any WCF service. Certainly when we talk about validation in a minute, that is definitely another one that I think we should just bake right into the WCF.
Okay.
So that's Queryable. The other one I wanted to talk about was change set. I think that's another kind of big-ish concept. As you mentioned, one of the things we learned from remoting is you can't have a really chatty interface. You can't, every time I set a property on an entity, I don't want to go back to the server and change that property. Essentially, the model I want to do with ARIA is I want to bring down a bunch of data. I want to perform a bunch of local operations on my data, create new instances, updated instances, delete some instances, and then package that up as a change set and send it as a batch up to the server in one network call. And then on the server, what I want to do is kind of run through that change set and apply each one of the changes in a natural programming.
Hey everybody, this is Scott coming at you from another place and time. No doubt you probably bump into testing tasks now and then in your work, And you know, writing functional tests is probably not your favorite thing. It's kind of difficult, takes time, and the results can be dubious. Well, get ready to start liking tests thanks to Telerik with the new WebEye testing framework. Building web automation tests is a breeze. You've got code automation with advanced ASP.NET Ajax and Silverlight applications. You can write a single test, have it executed against multiple browsers at once. You benefit from a rich API. There's link support, integration with Visual Studio unit testing, also NUnit, XUnit, and MBUnit. Not to mention the free wrappers for Telerik RAD controls for ASP.NET Ajax and Silverlight, all shipping with Telerik's new testing tool. One of the best features, the WebEye testing framework, which is developed by Art of Test, is it's absolutely free. If you've already got hooked on WebEye testing framework, start using it right away. Go to Telerik.com for more info. Thanks a lot.
Is the user aware of this? I mean, they make a change, and then click save. And then you're handling change tracking on the client, and then you batch it up?
That's right. Well, I think we can leave as a separate discussion, what do we think the right actual end user experience for that is? But yeah, the demos we do have like a submit button on them where you make a change, click submit. But you're right. So what we do on the client is some change tracking, so we know what's changed, and then submit that batch to the server. And then what's nice is on the server is you just write a method called update employee, delete employee, and create new employee. And whenever a change set comes in that has an update employee on it, we'll go and create .NET objects associated with that, give you the original value, give you the value out of the database, and let you handle what you want to do to actually update that employee.
Okay. And would you think about that in the context of being atomic?
Yes. So we do think of change sets as being atomic. So when you send a change set in, either all the operations pass or none of them do. And the transactional kind of capability there is really up to whatever the data access layer you're using is. But yeah, we certainly with something like Link to SQL or in Hibernate or Entity Framework, those changes would get rolled back. And you would get a message back on the server that said, here is the one that had an issue. Give you a chance to fix that, and you can resubmit the changes.
Okay, and that actually, you brought up in Hibernate, and you brought up some other things. Is RIA services specific to a backend, or is it only specific to the iQueryable?
Yeah, so basically, it in some sense, it's not even specific to iQueryable. You can if you can return an iEnumerable, you can work in the system. Of course, if you turn an iEnumerable, you're sucking all that data into memory, but you can totally do that. So no, one of the design points for RIA services was essentially to provide an adaption layer to kind of help you work with any backend that you want to work in. We think there's a diversity of those, and we think that will continue for the foreseeable future. But what we wanted you to be able to do is, for example, move from an on-premises SQL Server running Entity Framework to SSDS. To the SQL, what's it called now? The cloud-hosted SQL Server, SQL Azure.
Azure,
yeah. Without having to replumb the UI. I mean, you could imagine in the two-tier world we talked about at the top, if you wanted to move from SQL Server to Azure, that would be a significant change to the UI layer. I mean, the different kind of model for working with the data completely. With RIA services, you may have to change your implementations of some of the query methods, for example, or some of the create, update, delete methods, but you wouldn't have to change the Silverlight client at all.
I see. Okay. So there's an adapter that you speak one thing between. Okay, so it formalizes the conversation between Silverlight and the back end. And then from there, and that is over the iQueryable interface as well as others. And then from there, it's up to you to pull the data from wherever. So I could do RIA services and pull data from an AS400 or a mainframe if I felt like it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. So I did this, customers asked me a few kind of not esoteric ones, but not Entity Framework and Link to SQL. And so I've worked on a few. I did ADO.NET with data sets, We have a ton of people with data, model of data sets, and that turns out that works just fine with our system. We have one with data reader and data writer. I did one in Hibernate. I did one, this was an interesting one. I did one with the data source being a WCF service.
Wow.
So to get the data, you call another service, and then that handles the data access. So we think of that as like a four-tier scenario. And there are definitely people who have that model.
And because this is a WCF service, does this mean that I have a lot of flexibility about what I can, how I can protect it as far as authentication? I mean, can I use, you know, I can use SSL, I can use authentication, I can use IPsec. I mean, what kind of things can I do? Like, if I were going to write a banking application in Silverlight, would this still be a way to do it?
Yeah, like I said, it's a regular WCF service. By default, it starts with no config. So there's no, nothing in WebConfig, no kind of stuff to keep in sync and blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
And we hope that a lot of customers will be able to use that model and don't have to go and do a bunch of customization. But it's nice to know that it's there if you need it. So what you can do is you can, there's a well-known name for the WCF endpoint that's there. And so you can go into WebConfig and you can customize that literally like any other WCF service. So you can manage the thing. You can go add additional endpoints. We think it'll be super common to add additional endpoints. And then you can go and even change the endpoints that we put in there by default to talk to the Silverlight client.
Mm-hmm.
When you start doing that, when you start changing the default endpoints that are there, chances are you might have to go to the Silverlight client and change the defaults that are there too so that those kind of work well together. But it's factored well.
Is this currently a separate thing. It's a separate download. When is this going to be baked into Silverlight such that this is the way to do things?
Yeah, so it's a separate download. And it is, I love it because, you know, it is both a server and client component. Like, we're literally living the .NET dream of server and client. So we're actually right now, today, having conversations about do we... Mm-hmm. Just put all this stuff in the Silverlight SDK and have the Silverlight SDK now can be installed on servers, or do we have a separate install that is like ASP MVC that installs on the server?
Mm-hmm.
So I expect we'll work that out pretty soon. But I think what you should see is the tooling experience that we're going to have in Dev 10 will really make it feel like this is a great option for getting data from your server into the Silverlight client. Now, of course, there's still going to be WCF, generic WCF support in mm-hmm. Silverlight to call.
But is it fair to make that the declarative statement? I'm trying to pin you down a little bit, that if you're going to move data back and forth and you're going to use Silverlight, this is the preferred way. Not the only way. There's certainly people have been doing it other ways before, but this is how you do it.
Here's what I would say. In our V1, you know, I got to scope everything to a time frame. In the V1, I would think this is the best model if you're talking to your server.
I see. Okay, so.
Do you see what I mean? So if it's the Silverlight client talking to its server, so I'm building one app, there's a server piece and a client piece.
Mm-hmm.
I think Rhea Services is the best possible solution to that. But certainly we see apps that get data from other sources, right? That call IMDb or, you know, Amazon to go get data to build out their app. And you could probably use Rhea Services on the client to go do that, but maybe it wouldn't be the best.
Okay. So I wouldn't use Rhea Services to write a Twitter client.
Yeah. It's funny that Nikhil Kattari actually has an example of how to go do that. I would only use Rhea Services to write a Twitter client if really what you're doing is you're getting the Twitter data from the server. And then on the server, you're mashing it up with your own data. Like, you're augmenting it with additional information that you keep. And then you're sending it down in a coherent way down to the client. And then I would use Rhea Services for that pipe between your server and the client. But to get the actual data from Twitter, no, I would.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, frankly, I'd probably use web requests to get the data from the Twitter's REST service.
Okay, but if I was, you know, bradabramsbank.com and I was switching from a web-based banking system and I was going to build a whole banking client and we'd be talking back to bradabrams.com, then that might be something I would use Rhea Services for.
Yeah, absolutely. So, hey, one of the ones we didn't talk about related to Chainset that I wanted to mention is the data validation store. I think that's a pretty interesting one.
That's a good point.
Some of your listeners might remember data annotation. Do you know this thing in component model?
Right, and this is something that I've used in ASP.NET MVC.
Yes, that's right. So we originated it in dynamic data, and then more recently we picked it up with ASP MVC. Do you want to give the pitch on it?
Sure. Well, I don't want the pitch. I want to dig into it.
No. I want you to give the pitch on it.
No, on data annotations.
Yeah.
Well, so as I understand it, the idea is that, as you have attributes, and we've had attributes for years, attributes are little post-it notes that you put on objects, and data annotations are, I think they're in system.componentModel.dataAnnotations?
Yeah.
Which is not system.web.this.that, and it's not system.servolite.whatever.whatever, it's system.componentModel. So it's a formalization of the fact that a string might have an email address or a phone number or a social security number in it, or a long might have more meaning and it might need to be within a range of 1 to a million. That information isn't held by the data type. So it's data annotations that provide additional constraints and information that the standard .NET data type doesn't provide. And it's put in system.componentModel because it is fundamental and can be used anywhere. It's specific to enhancing the type system, not specific to any particular implementation. I think people are familiar with it because they saw it in ASP.NET Dynamic Data and they saw it in MVC. So you're using that too, is what you're saying.
Exactly. And what I think is really interesting in the interior case of that, because what we've done is it's the exact same way you annotate your data model with that data annotation stuff to say, this field is read-only, or like you said, the string length on this can only be this big. And then we actually propagate that data down to the client. And then we've augmented all the controls in Silverlight to know about that. And so you get actual nice kind of red squiggly pop-ups that whenever, as a user, you violate that. So read-only fields really are read-only. If you say the string length can't be more than 10 and you put 11 characters in there, boom, you pop up a little red thing that tells you what it shows you the error message. So you get a really nice user experience there. But in addition, we validate the exact same thing again on the server. So, for example, if you didn't hit it with a Silverlight client, if you hit it with Hanselman's custom client that doesn't honor all those rules, we want to make sure that those data validations really happen. So there's actually a pipeline that runs before your update method is called. We run all the data annotation validations on that entity to ensure that it's a valid entity before you get it. And that's for kind of the obvious security concerns there.
And is this happening on the client or the server?
It's both. So it happens on the client to give you the great UX, and it happens on the server to give you the security.
I see. Okay. So someone could potentially intercept that traffic and decide to push it back to the server, and then we catch it again. But the idea is that for the best experience, you grab it on the client side, but you only have to write it once?
That's right. So we've been talking about the easy case, which is amazing. Microsoft hasn't solved it up to this point. The easy case is just like string length or required or whatever. But actually, real business logic usually involves kind of writing some code. And so what we've done now is you can actually write a data validation rule yourself, like applying to the whole entity that it says, start date can't be before end date. Oh, I guess that could be end date can't be before start date or whatever. This credit card number has to match this sort of pattern. And you can write that as a .NET method. And we will bring that down to the client, and we'll execute it. Every time the user changes some value in that entity, we will run your rule. And then if it doesn't work, we'll display the right UI. And then we'll run exactly that same code again on the server.
Okay. At what point do you think that this will be mainstream? You kept saying V1. Obviously, you're setting expectations for the first version.
Yeah. So right now we have a go live license out there. And so, you know, a lot of people are already using it in kind of a pre-release form, kind of the people that like to be on the bleeding edge. And then we're going to do a beta here at PDC. We just finished our code completely for that. So PDC people will have a beta. And then I think, you know, being the typical Microsoft vagaries, I think kind of early next year we'll see an RTM, kind of based on the feedback we get at Mix and whatnot. I mean, at PDC.
And do you think that this will extend out to things like WPF, or would I want to use this in any non-Silverlight scenarios?
So I think there's kind of two really interesting ways that the work we've done here with RIA services for Silverlight is going to extend out. One, we've already touched a good bit on, which is using some of the stuff like the validation store and the iQueryables just in any WCF service. I think that'll be super valuable kind of thing to go happen. And getting all that stuff into WSDL so everything just works. So that's one place it'll expand out over time. And then the other place it'll expand out is into other kind of programming models. So we've done Silverlight today. And today we've also done ASP.NET. So, for example, if you want to write this query method, this create, update, and delete, all of that stuff, but have the client be an ASP.NET page, you can totally go do that. We have a very efficient in-proc way to go make that happen. So, for example, if you wanted to build a standards-based web head as well as a rich Silverlight head, but didn't want to write your business logic twice for that, you can totally go use RIA services for that.
Now, wouldn't that change things in a big way, though, because ASP.NET and web applications in general are kind of one request and then you know, tear it down, start it all over again, as opposed to the persistence that we have in a RIA application?
Yeah, it's interesting. ASP.NET has this data source pattern associated with it that we talked about before. So we've actually built a ASP.NET domain data source that you can point at our RIA services domain service. And essentially what it does is it builds up a chain set and then calls our data source. So kind of in the web forms model, I think it works pretty nicely to kind of build up a page that is then sent down to the client. Does that make sense? So think about this. Dynamic data today. ASP.NET dynamic data. Today, all you can do is annotate the model with those custom attributes we talked about. You're still accessing the database directly. What if instead you wanted to write some business logic to return only employees whose salary is greater than $10,000? That's tough to do with dynamic data today. Sure. And if you instead use the domain services model, you just go put that in the query method.
Ah, okay. Now, couldn't you do that with Astoria today, though, if you plugged in the query interceptor?
Yeah, so Astoria has a query interceptor model, and they have interceptors for...
Astoria being the ADO.NET data services.
Yeah. I think Astoria is best for building this kind of REST-based services. And I think that, we're talking with the Astoria guys, too, about it supporting the same sort of CUD, kind of create, update, delete pattern with kind of specific methods for those. Because we're seeing a lot of people kind of gravitate to that sort of model rather than the interceptor model. You mentioned other programming models. So the other ones on our radar, I think Ajax is a really natural one. It does have all of the client-side batching and whatever that needs to happen. So we're definitely looking hard at Ajax. Things like WPF and whatnot is definitely on our list as well for the future.
Okay, cool. Hey, someone on Twitter wanted to know how long you've been at Microsoft. Because, it's funny, when I talk to different Microsoft people, again, I've only been there, I think I've been there 2 years now this week.
Wow, congratulations.
They'll say things like super excited. You can tell if someone's been there a long time. How long have you been at Microsoft?
Well, I am super excited to tell you that I've been at Microsoft for about 12 years. Yeah, so I started on Internet Explorer way back in the day. And then I moved to the GLR kind of way back when we were fighting the Java VM. Those were good days, man. That was a lot of fun. I was the first program manager for System.Object, and System.string, so you can blame me for those. I wrote the specs for those. That was a lot of fun. And then I moved on.
You wrote the spec for System.object?
Yes, I did.
You should put that on a t-shirt.
Yes.
Just walk around, just, you know, I'm that guy.
Yeah. Yeah, I actually have a lot of, you know, a lot of, I feel like I've learned a lot. There's definitely some things I would do differently about that. Maybe we could have a different show about, you know, how would we do it over if we could now. But overall, I think it's proven to be pretty successful. I eventually moved on to ASP.NET and did ASP Ajax and ASP MVC. At least started ASP MVC, and then more recently moved over to work on Silverlight, make Silverlight kind of great for line of business apps. And did this navigation framework and a bunch of data form, data control in Silverlight 3. And then now with Rhea Services, hopefully we can kind of round out the picture on how to build these apps.
How many, just out of curiosity before we go, how many people were on the original team that were building .NET versus how many people are on the kind of the whole thing now?
Well, way back, like really originally, I think it was, there were maybe 10 people, 15 people that kind of formed the original team. Now, the thing is, I think it's really interesting to see how this stuff happens at Microsoft. What happens is other teams just kind of clombed on. So, for example, ASP.NET, what would later become ASP.NET, started not too long after we started the CLR. And they were a whole separate team that I don't want to guess how big, but it was pretty small. And then they significantly added to kind of what would be .NET when they joined on kind of to kind of partner with us in building what would be .NET. And then the same thing happened when Visual Studio and the languages kind of piled on. So, I don't know, does that answer it? It started small and it snowballed.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever think it would be anything? Did you honestly think it was going to be something?
Oh, yeah. No, I was a huge believer from day one. You have to do these V1s at a big company. You have to have what I would call this irrational exuberance. and you have to believe that what you're doing is going to change the world, or else you can't keep, because there's so much stacked against you in making that happen. I mean, literally every month we were one meeting away from getting killed, you know, like this, go to this next exec review and they may decide to stop funding this thing. Right. So it was, you had to keep a really strong, positive, we're going to change the world sort of attitude. But that's a lot of fun, right? I mean, what do you want to do? I want to come to work every day and believe in changing the world, and maybe I will. So.
I hope I have that amount of Kool-Aid after 12 years. If I make it 12 years, if you don't have me fired sometime in the next 12 years.
No, man, you got to have the Kool-Aid.
Cool. Well, thanks a lot for chatting with me today. I really appreciate it. And then where do people go to learn about this? Do they just Google with Bing, or how do they find that information?
Yeah, just Bing it, Bing Rhea Services. I think the easiest thing to do is go to silverlight.net. There's forums on there on Rhea Services. You can get download our latest bit. People can find my blog. And of course, you can Twitter me as well. And we can definitely get people hooked up.
Cool. And you're B. Abrams on Twitter, right?
I'm Brad A.
Brad A. All right. Very cool. Thanks a lot. This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.